Good morning. It is Sunday, August 4th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This past week, on Friday, we celebrated the third anniversary of Ozarks at Large becoming a daily show. It used to be right here on Sunday mornings and are now daily. And so we celebrated with the traditional third anniversary gift, leather, with all stories about leather.
So ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we visit a cobbler, a saddle maker, and we hear music from Jed Clampett inside the Firm and Garner Performance Studio.
But before we celebrate a third anniversary, let's look back at the past 7 days with Timothy Dennis and the Week in Review.
Earlier this week, we got an update on construction of Interstate 49 through Arkansas. Completing I-49 through the state has long been a goal of the state's Highway Transportation Department. In Arkansas, the interstate will include what is to become the Bella Vista Bypass, current portions of Interstate 540, and new sections of I-540 currently under construction. Danny Strasley of the Arkansas Highway Transportation Department says that one of those sections under construction is an extension of the interstate through the Chaffee Crossing area in the River Valley.
It'll be a new connection from I-40 down to the Chaffee Crossing. And then from south of the Chaffee Crossing location all the way down through, you know, just the western side of the state where you've got communities like Mena, DeQueen, and on down into Little River County on to where I-30 exists.
Strasley says that early cost estimates for completing the stretch of I-49 from south of Fort Smith to Texarkana are around $2.2 billion, and that includes both design and construction costs. Strasley says that no overall funding has been allocated for the stretch of Interstate 49 that will run through the Ouachita Mountains.
But, you know, as these other components are put together, I mean, it makes sense to do the work on what will become I-49 in northwest Arkansas because of the population center and the traffic volume. It makes sense to work on what will become I-49 in southwest Arkansas at Texarkana. That's a major entry port into the state through Interstate 30. The traffic volumes support it, and of course, once it's connected through to Louisiana, you'll see a lot of traffic coming up from that state as well.
Interstate 49 will eventually connect New Orleans to Kansas City. As the highway is set to intersect Interstate 40 in Crawford County, area leaders have long eyed the economic benefits that the area will reap from having a major north-south and a major east-west corridor meet in the area. But it could be many years before that corridor is completed. But a project that will visually connect cities in northwest Arkansas is getting underway right now. New wayfinding signs will soon be installed in the cities across northwest Arkansas. The pilot project is a partnership among the cities and the Northwest Arkansas Council. Robert Smith is the communications specialist for the council.
So what people will see this month is about 60 signs in the 7 cities. Over the course of the next few years, really, you'll see another 200 signs go up. Five of the 7 cities have decided to put up all of their signs. So there's this initial pilot project that is the 60 signs, and then most of the rest will be up before the end of this year, and then you'll see a total of 260 signs.
The pilot project is being paid for by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation. Smith says that while most residents in the area know how to get to Arvest Ballpark in Springdale or where Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is in Bentonville, the signs will point to other destinations, such as the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale, the Rogers Aquatic Park, and city halls and parks throughout the area. But he says that the signs will also be helpful for visitors to the area as well.
It's really a confidence builder. You feel a little bit like an insider when you go to a place and you know you can easily move from point A to point B. The hope is that you go back to where you're from and you talk about that experience, and that positive experience, that ease in getting from point A to point B will convince others to visit Northwest Arkansas.
Cities participating in the program include Bentonville, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Eureka Springs, Lowell, Siloam Springs, and Bella Vista. And getting between all of those cities in an electric car may be a little bit easier. Drivers of electric vehicles now have one more publicly accessible connection to the power grid in this area. A new charging station has been installed in the public parking lot across from the Fayetteville City Administration Building. Peter Nierengarten, Sustainability Director for the City of Fayetteville, says that Level 2 charging stations, like the one installed at the Mountain Street lot, do provide faster charging than most at-home chargers, but the fill-up time is still considerably longer than pumping a tank of gas.
If a vehicle were to pull in with a nearly depleted battery, they'd be looking at 6 to 8 hours of charging time at the station. You know, if they had only a half-depleted battery, they'd probably be looking at more like 2 to 3 hours of charging time to completely top their battery off. And our hope is that electric vehicle owners will choose to park at this location, and then while their vehicle's parking, they'll do some shopping at some of our downtown businesses, maybe visit the Fayetteville Farmers Market. You'll cruise down to Dixon Street, just take advantage of all there is to offer in downtown Fayetteville while their vehicle is being filled up with electricity, so to speak.
The charging station is only the fifth in Northwest Arkansas and the third to be installed in Fayetteville. The next closest stations include one in Fort Smith and one in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Nierengarten says that Ozarks Electric Cooperative approached the city with the idea of installing a charging station on a city-owned lot.
So basically they would pay for the purchase of the charging station, and then all we had to do was come up with the money for the installation, so the electrical work to actually plumb the thing in, hook it up to an electric meter, which cost about $1,000. And we used some leftover grant money from a 2010 Home Depot grant to pay that portion.
Nierengarten says that the city won't assess a fee for drivers charging their electric vehicles other than the normally metered fees for parking in the lot. In the Harold and Blanche Calk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
The door buzzer heard from the workroom of Clarity's Cobbler Shop on College Avenue in Fayetteville. In the 1950s, when the original store, Webb's Shoe Repair, opened, shoes were made quite a bit differently than they are today, with leather soles stitched onto the bottom of the shoe. Stephen Clarity's father bought the shop in 1981. You might notice that I'm saying Clarity, not Clardy. I've always called it Clarity's Cobbler Shop, as I understand many others do as well. Stephen says they don't correct the customers. He bought the shop 4 years ago when his father was undergoing a heart transplant. He drew from his childhood experience of growing up here to master the trade.
Yeah, a lot of the paint on the walls that's not supposed to be there. That's been the nails in the bench here. Yeah, that was our pastime whenever before we could do actual repairs. We thought we were working. Yeah, I grew up here. My dad has owned the shop since he was when he was 18 years old.
Stephen, along with his three brothers, spent many a day fixing shoes. His brother Drew owns and runs Drew Clarity's Shoe Repair in Bentonville. Stephen says that when he was 13, his dad had them sign a contract that said they each had 10% ownership of the shop and had to work 2 days a week. At 16, Stephen went into the medical field, but quickly changed careers when his father became ill. The place is still very much a family business. His wife, Cecilia, works at one bench dyeing leather purses, shoes, and such. Their four children, aged 2, 5-year-old twins, and 7, run around the shop and nap in another room. The oldest, Lexi, wants to be a cobbler when she grows up. A man's black cowboy boot is upside down, about waist high, sitting on a vintage iron shoe holder that's affixed to the floor, allowing Stephen to hammer a sole onto the bottom of the boot. As he does, he talks about the meaning of the word cobbler.
Cobblery, in the old English term, means to cobble something together, whereas in the cobblers wouldn't just do shoe repair for a living. You could bring in anything to them. They did roofing, they did framing, they did a little bit of plumbing, they would fix anything, and so the term cobble became like a cobblestone, you know, a grouping together of all these different things. And so when Dad opened the shop, he changed the name from shoe repair to a cobbler shop, because we literally have our hands in just about everything. We don't just do shoe and boot repair. We're true cobblers.
Yes, because if you look at these shelves.
His wife, Cecilia, jumps in.
It looks like a bunch of junk, and you know, it looks messy back here, but all this stuff he uses, all of these random pieces and things, he takes it off of broken things that can't be repaired, and then he'll reuse them and cobble something back together. Yes, baby?
Ella's being really mean to Izzy.
You can tell the mood is usually light around Clarity's. While Stephen doesn't plumb, he does do a little bit of everything. In addition to repairing 25 to 50 pair of shoes each day, including Birkenstocks and Chacos, they fix luggage, purses, lawn chairs, umbrellas, belts, watches, leather jackets, And there's even a Bentley parked out back. Stephen and Cecilia are fixing the leather seats. Stephen's favorite thing to work on, however, is a traditional pair of shoes.
A pair of nice dress Allen Edmonds shoes that I'm doing full soles on. And all the businessmen out there know exactly what I'm talking about. Allen Edmonds shoes, just a wonderful brand of shoes. It's one of the only dress shoes still made in America, handmade in America. And they last forever, and they're just a joy to work on because they're meant to be resold over and over.
And his favorite thing to wear.
Tony Lama cowboy boots.
Right.
Personally. And they're also really nice to work on, any.
And there are a lot of boots around the shop. He picks up a pair of colorful ladies' cowboy boots and takes them over to the stitcher to sew on a new leather sole. Just about every work item is original to the shop, like the workbench Stephen hammered nails into as a child. But this machine, the curved needle stitcher, goes even further back.
My grandmother worked at the, I can't remember the shoe store name, but it was in the Campbell Bell building on the square, which is still there. You can see that black sign with the silver lettering Campbell Bell. And they made shoes in there, and they also repaired them. And that was, her first job was early 50s. And the stitcher that's actually right behind you, which I use every day to sew soles on, is the original stitcher from that Campbell Bell building that got brought over here when Webb bought the shop.
He says shoe repairing and making equipment hasn't changed all that much, and that he can still buy parts for the almost 100-year-old machine. It's large and green and looks similar to many sewing machines, but it's called a curved needle because, well, it has a curved needle.
And it curves up through the welt. It's sort of hard to describe this, but curves up through the welt, through the sole, and then creates a stitch, of course. And that's the stitch that you see if you wear a leather-soled shoe. You're probably you can turn it over and see. It's either called it's either stitched on with a curved needle or with a McKay needle. McKay stitches through the actual shoe, and the curved needle is going to stitch through the actual welt, which is on the outside of the shoe.
Stephen previously worked in surgery, where he was taught about safety with sharp objects. He says that cobbling is a bit different. The only profession that you're taught to cut and sew toward yourself, because it gives you a better cut. There's another large green machine against that same wall, with belts of sandpaper. It's the grinder, which Stephen says he tries to fire up just twice a day, as it is very noisy.
Grinder helps me trim the sole to actually fit because if I just put the sole on there, it's usually too big. And so we trim it off and make it a nice edge. So it looks like almost like it's factory. As close as possible. Same thing with heels. I'll order a whole bunch of heels and then just trim them to fit.
Celia, Stephen's wife, has her own workbench, stacked with dozens and dozens of colorful bottles of dye. She's modest about her work, primarily dyeing worn or stained leather bags. But her hand-painted work is fabulous, turning a salmon-colored purse to blue to match a soaked-in-ink spot, or returning a worn brown or cognac-colored bag back to like new condition.
When I started doing it, I use brushes, and I'm really picky, and I'm really detailed. I like to get, you know, I wish we could dip it. Boy, would that make it easy. But no, I like to really get in and get all these nice edges and stuff like that and refinish all this stuff. And, you know, I'll take an acetone this stuff off of there. But
again, she is modest and truly impressed with her husband's handiwork, saying that he lives up to the standard that her father-in-law kept for so many years. Together, they work on 24,000 items a year, a number they could only calculate by figuring how many red tags, you'll see them attached to everything in the shop, they go through in 1 year. Stephen says just about anything can be repaired and urges people to try to fix their favorite shoes and leather items before tossing them out, commenting that cobbling was one of the first sustainable businesses. No matter how bad the item, don't worry, they'll laugh with you, not at you.
Usually it's very repairable. A seam that's come unsewn, a big rip, there's
a dog chew.
You know, we've fixed shoes that are literally almost half gone from the dog. And Of course, it's always going to look a little like a dog chew, but we can definitely get you back in your favorite pair. A hole in your soul, no pun intended there. We can fill that. Yeah. Really, if you have something, what I always tell customers, because they ask me what all we can fix is, hey, I'm on the radio here. Sorry, don't laugh at me. If you have something that you don't know where else to take it and it's broken and needs to be fixed, we'll probably take a whack at it or maybe fix it.
It took me a second there.
Yeah, I know.
I'm a cobbler's daughter. I'm thought of rude and mean, but to find her. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Ahead on this edition, stories about leather, celebrating our third anniversary as a daily show, Leather the Traditional Gift. And Antoinette,
yes,
we're going to begin with a gentleman who has worked with leather for nearly four decades.
Yes, we're going to take a visit to Nelson's Leather Shop.
Jim Nelson, he and his wife Susan moved to Northwest Arkansas from Minneapolis, St. Paul nearly 40 years ago. They'd met in school at KU in Lawrence, Kansas. Then Jim got his MFA in drawing and art at Syracuse. Then they visited Eureka Springs in late summer in the mid-70s, and that's when Eureka Springs kind of closed down at the end of summer.
But at the same time, having looked at it, I thought, gosh, this place is wonderful, man. This has got some potential. And there just wasn't a whole lot going on. There were still actual little town businesses that existed in the downtown historic district that have been long gone, but they were there at that time. And I mean, rents were real cheap, and it was just pretty easy to get started on doing something. So anyway, we ended up wanting to be there, but ended up in Fayetteville on Dixon Street, where Flying Possum ended up.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
And we started that shop in October. I think we opened in September or October of 74 and ran it with the idea that we were going to also have the next year have another leather shop in Eureka Springs. We were going to start. We were
That's
young.
That's very ambitious.
And very ambitious. We were young and energetic, and it just seemed like, yeah, well, let's do that. Right before we were going to do the Eureka shop, the people that we had lined up to run this decided to join Hare Krishna. And so they went to California, and we ended up moving to Eureka Springs ourselves and starting the shop there.
You have your MFA in painting and drawing.
Right.
So on one hand, I can see how it goes to leather working, because it's, mm-hmm. to a non-artist like myself, oh, well, they're connected. But are they? I mean,
The connection is simply, to me, it's working with your hands. That's the deal. And just doing handwork. What I do in my work now, I work with wood, and I carve it. And I used to carve the leather or stamp it, and it's very similar. And when I paint or color the wooden wall art that I do now, I use my hands a lot. I use brushes, but I use rags and I use my hands. And that, to me, is direct comes directly from working the way I used to dye belts and other hard leather things. It's the handwork, though. That's the real connection. And I suppose, tried pottery or glass or something.
How confident were you as a small business owner?
It wasn't really confidence as much as why not. It was let's see what happens. Let's try this. We had a little bit of money that we were given just as seed money by my in-laws to get us when we got married, and that's what we used to get going with. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like we can do this. It's just okay. You make the stuff and then you sell the stuff, and and it was so simple. That's all it's ever really been. And hope that you made enough that you can feed your face.
Eureka Springs is a magnet that attracts a lot of people.
Yes.
A lot of people think they can come make a living, and find out it's not easy.
Yes.
And leave. What was it about Eureka that kept you here?
Well, the artists, the diversity, the potential for, at the time, you could start there so inexpensively, there just wasn't a lot of downside. You know, it's different now. It's more expensive to be there. You can't just kind of dabble and see what happens unless you've got some capital to start with. At least that's how I feel about it. It's changed a lot. And I think it's doing very well. It's not exploding the way it was in the 80s and 90s. But it's viable, and I think it always will be. It's an authentic place. People really live there. They live and work. Like, and live above where they're working. I mean, it's
not like Carmel, California, where everyone who works there can't afford to live
or
there.
Or Aspen,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not like that. It's the real deal. And as long as people who come to Eureka Springs and maybe fall in love with the place and decide they've got to be there someday, as long as that continues to happen, I think the town will just be fine. It'll be great. Most of the old homes and buildings that were in various states of disrepair, almost all of that has disappeared. It's for the better. People have really taken these various places, big and small, and polished them up very nicely. The town itself looks pretty good, I think, from a visual artist perspective. It's a pretty place. It's visually very stimulating. And so that's all good. There's more people coming there to do outside things, canoe and fish, bicycle. There's a lot that didn't exist at all.
And a lot more cuisine.
And a lot more cuisine. And we have, the restaurants are, we have such fine restaurants. For a town our size, it's unbelievable, really. And it seems as though we've got more than we've ever had. We also have way more artists in general, of all kinds, than we've ever had. Supposedly there's something like 400 artists in town.
I can believe that,
And in the surrounding area. Yeah. It was nothing like that when we were there. There were artists, but, I mean, there are lots and lots, and they keep coming.
If a 25 or 26-year-old came to you and said, I've got this, I have an entrepreneurial spirit, and I want to go, what advice would you give them?
That's really, really tough. It's just the stakes are higher. You've got to have some capital. Even if you're making everything yourself, you still have to have access to money. So that's important. Don't have your expectations be minimal. Just simply try to survive, at least to start with, and then build it from there. And take time to have fun. I wish there were more younger people that were coming to town and getting into business. There's lots of young people that come to town. They work for existing businesses. They're musicians. And some of them are artists. Most of the artists that seem to be coming to town that I'm aware of, they're older. They're not 25, 26-year-olds for the most part.
Well, you and I are from different generations. I don't know what it costs for you to go to KU in the late 60s, early 70s. I went to the University of Arkansas in the early 80s. But you could get out of Arkansas without much debt at all.
Right.
And if you had any, it didn't take long to pay it off. And that's different now.
That's way different. And it worries me that so many kids are having to face that right out of school. I just think that's... I don't know. I don't think it's not horrible, but it forces you to be a money manager. When I think about when we started in business, I was 28, and I knew nothing about banks or really how things like that worked. It was, again, going back to, it was just the simplest. I buy it for a dollar, I'll sell it for $2. That's what it came down to for me.
When you were making leather,
mm-hmm.
and you knew that it was going to go, you were, in order to survive, it was going to be sold. Mm-hmm. That was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Much the same with art, but what you're doing now is somewhat different.
It's non-functional. It's non-utilitarian.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it harder to give those pieces up?
It was at first, but as I've accumulated a nice inventory of pieces, now I'm having fun, actually, letting them go and giving them to nonprofits and schools, and not for a tax write-off.
No, that doesn't happen anymore.
Just to get the work out and displayed and let other people appreciate it. It's not doing me any good at all sitting in some closet or a little warehouse. So that's what I'm doing now. And in that sense, it's quite different than the leather stuff because, you know, eventually somebody's going to wear every belt you've ever made, but not doesn't work that way with wall art necessarily.
Right. What should we know about working with leather? I mean,
one thing I was always kind of concerned about was that the perception that the animals are used for their hides rather than for their meat. This is a byproduct of the livestock industry rather than the reason for its existence. And I kind of struggled with that. This is the skin of a nice something or other.
Right.
And on the other hand, it's a traditional craft. It's been used for years and years and years. And so I did the best I could with it and tried to respect it and make it be something beautiful and useful. And I tried to express my creativity through the designs that I was the belt man. I did belts, and I did belts that using equipment or simple hand tools that I'd never seen anybody else do. And I liked that, just that. You know, and I tried to make them as good as I could possibly do, and they were finished real nice, and everybody liked them. So,
well, finally, here you are nearly four decades later. Mm-hmm. I guess that move from the Twin Cities to ultimately Eureka is okay?
Absolutely. I can't find anything. I mean, I just love living in Northwest Arkansas.
Jim Nelson owns Nelson Leather in Eureka Springs. I talked to him inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy news studio earlier this week.
And as we learned, Nelson owned the shop on Dixon Street.
Yes, the first Nelson Leather was actually on Dixon Street, which then later became Flying Possum.
Which is related to our next story, Antoinette.
Yes, the late Bruce Walker created a patented leather guitar strap, and he worked at the Flying Possum Leather that we just mentioned. And I wanted to get a musician in here who had one of those straps, so I brought in Jed Clampett, who actually got one of the first straps. And while he was here, he told me a little bit about how he knew Bruce.
Bruce Walker and the Flying Possum, he and I met in 1976 when I first started playing at the Old Town Club in the Mountain Inn. And Bruce came in there and saw me one night. And we just hit it off. We were kindred spirits, you know. And he said, you know, I got a little leather shop down here. I do a real nice wheat straw pattern, you know. And anyway, so back then, I've got a couple of guitar straps, and I've got the very first one that he made for me in 76, and then even had some additions. So I still have that one with my other guitar, and the one I have with this guitar is a newer version. It's a little padded thing, and it's still that same thing. But then I have the patented strap, which I use. I keep it at home. I've got a 1939 Gibson guitar. It's very fragile, and you know, it was a gift, so I don't want to put a hole in it, so I use, when I want to play it, I use that strap, because you can put it on without having to put a neck pin in it. And Bruce, you know, we'd just been friends through the years, and of course, I wear Flying Possum sandals, have since 1976, and all my belts are from him. All my leather goods always came from the Possum. And when he came up with this strap, it was his idea. It was a total surprise to me that I would get one, plus besides being number three. But I'm pretty sure Willie got number one, and Neil Young got number two, and I got number three. And it's, you know, it's a wonderful thing.
So you guys were just friends, and you were just lucky enough to get one of the first ones. Now, I've always heard about these straps, you know, this patented Walker strap. What is so unique about it?
It's a wonderful thing. What it does is down here on the bottom side of your guitar, He makes kind of a loop out of it. It fastens back on the tail piece back here. Then it kind of loops around and comes here and catches over this and comes over your shoulder. It's a really unique kind of thing, and it's great for, you know, when, because a lot of people have high-dollar guitars, you know, and they don't want to be putting little, like this one. This is a working guitar here.
Yeah, you have the little peg mount to where you put your strap on.
When I'm on stage, my hands, you know, I may be bending over, I may be doing all this stuff, and I really strap it on. But it's like I say, it's a working guitar. But, you know, guys that spend thousands of dollars, you know, they want to keep them as pristine as possible, and it's real good for that. So works great, and they're still available. And, of course, the standard straps, you know, I've got those, too. I got everything pretty much that I could get from him. it was always good. It still is.
To be one of the first ones to get one of those straps, and especially in that company of musicians, you were surprised, but did you feel a sense of, I don't know, honor or something?
Well, of course,
to be?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's first of all, you know, that he would even think about me, and, you know, of course, we're good friends, but you know, they're real nice straps, and to get a numbered one from Bruce, and I like number three anyway. good things come in. Major chord comes in three
there
notes,
you go.
You know. And yeah, it was quite an honor, and I treasure it. You know, it's something I'll keep for always. And anything that you know, leather is real earthy anyway. You know, and it wears well and stays with you. Number three, as a matter of fact. Oh, it's the third anniversary, too, isn't it?
It is our third anniversary, which is why we have leather.
Well, how about that?
Well, how about that? It works out perfectly.
I love that.
Do you have to do much to take care of the leather strap? Do you need to use oil or anything like that to keep it in good condition? Or does it just wear pretty well?
Oh, they wear great. They wear great. You can, they sell something down at the shop called Lexol that you can put on leather products and stuff. But and I do that every now and then on mine, but This one I got in my strap on in my case here. I'm headed for New York tomorrow. I'll be playing it up there, and but I've had it all over the country, and they wear well, they're just good stuff, you know. And I like things that are handmade. I like things that some craftsman made, not something that was, you know, mass produced, so to speak. You know, it's just I like things that have character to them. You know, of course. You know, I'm Jed. I'm a little different, you know. But, you know, there's something, there's that feel in this. You know, you can see things and you can feel things. You hear stuff, you know. You can't see my words, but you can feel them. Just like music, you can't see it, but you can feel it. And I like things that feel good, you know. You know, whenever I go to buy anything, it has to have a certain feel about it. A friend of mine asked me once about buying a guitar, and he said, "Well, what should I look for, Jed?" And he said, "Well," I said, "Well, find one that feels good. You know, it doesn't matter who makes it or whatever. You know, it's going to have, you know, an appeal to you to start with. But you'll know when you play it. You know, it will either have that ooh baby feeling, or it won't. You know, and that's how I do things. Worked great so far."
And being here in Fayetteville seems to be working for you. You've been here 39 years this August.
It'll be 39 years this August, as a matter of fact.
People have been able to see you playing around here for a long time. You just mentioned you're headed to New York, but you're going to come back. And you mentioned before we start recording that you're working on some new songs. When can people hear you playing around town? Well, do you have any regular gigs?
I do. I have a regular gig. I play the Pesto Cafe every Tuesday, and it's... you know, it's as laid back as I can get. I just kind of sit in the corner and try to be not get anyone's attention, you know, because your ambiance, people, you just want to make a nice environment for people to have dinner. And that's, as musicians, we're supposed to make everyone comfortable and make you feel good, make you relax, you know. Music soothes the savage beast. I would be the savage beast that soothes me, you know. And I do that, but I'm doing some other things around town, too. I'm going to revive my Frank Bluebonnet Blues Band. I'll start doing that at a place, a friend of mine here in town called Rocks. I'm going to start doing that on Wednesday, starting August 7th. And it'll be kind of a jam thing that I'll host with some friends of mine. And I do a lot of private parties. Probably 80% of my work is private events, you know, but... I can play in people's living rooms. You know, I do a solo, duo, trio, full band, whatever's necessary. You know, And I love being back in Fayetteville. I'm just now starting to get back out and get around and get to know some of the other players again. Fayetteville's always had wonderful players. It's just always been a musical mecca. And, you know, and it's just got a good attitude. You know, when we learn here, I was allowed to practice here for all those years while I was trying to learn to sing and, you know, and do my thing. And it's just a great, great environment for that. You know, it's a learning center anyway. But yeah, I'll be around. Just and you know, I'm on Facebook. I got those things, and of course, at jedclampett.com.
Sure.
And I'm back. Good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, I'll be here for the duration.
You brought your guitar with you.
I did.
Would you mind playing a song for me? Tell me what it is, and
can you hear that?
I can.
I wrote this when I was. I'd been in Fayetteville, a few weeks, I guess, and I was going to write my parents a letter and let them know that where I was and what I was doing and I was okay. Of course, they didn't have a stamp or money for one, but anyway, it turned into a song, and it goes like this. I was just thinking about writing you a letter, let you know what's going on. There hasn't been much work and I've lost a little weight, but I'm gonna keep on keeping on. I met a lot of really nice people, there's still quite a few of them left around. I'm not getting very rich, but I'm getting real happy, so I'm writing every word of this down. And when I'm through, I'm sending it to you in a very, very special song. It might make your day just a little bit brighter, and you might want to sing along. Singing 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999. The ones I love, they miss me, you know I miss them too. But I play a guitar in a traveling band, cause that's what I wanted to do. Though this song, it may sound sad, it's not really sad at all. Cause things are gonna get a whole lot better, and better for us one and all. A new day's gonna be coming my way, and it's gonna be coming soon. But until it does, I'll just keep smiling, and I keep on singing this tune. Singing 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999, 9999. Now when you're down and feeling blue, cause everything's going wrong, think about me and remember what I told you. Keep on singing this song. Singing
You can find out more at jedclampett.com.
There's a couple of round end punches, hole punches. These are spring punches. One for each.
Jim Harwell has a myriad of awls, punches, scissors, edgers, scratchers, and cutters, categorized on a wall of his workshop in rural Prairie Grove, right next to the Illinois River. He uses those tools, all of them, to make custom saddles. He's been making saddles one at a time since he retired from a career in construction several years ago. He didn't enter into this new career lightly. He enrolled in and completed an 8-week one-on-one apprentice's course at a saddle-making school in Muscoota, Illinois. This interest in making saddles developed during winter months when he would take saddles off of his horses and begin to take them apart to clean them for the next riding season.
I used to work on old cars and always had parts left over, so I began to wonder if what would happen if I had parts left over on these saddles. It might be a problem. So, so I thought I would go learn a little bit about it, and I'm not much for going partial, so I just decided to go the whole route.
His teacher at the saddle-making school learned from another saddle-maker, invested in the old-school patient method. When Jim is working on a saddle, he says he'll spend a total of up to 130 hours working just to get the details just right. The first part of the process, making the saddle tree, can take 6 weeks. Think of the tree as the foundation, a chassis of the saddle. This is the form on which everything else will come together. And to make the tree, he meets the horse the eventual saddle will sit on when finished.
You get the tree to fit the horse, and then you start with the leather. To build a saddle, it takes two sides of cowhide for all the leather that you see. It takes one full sheepskin and a lot of hardware.
Hardware like the buckles, screws, and pins that will hold it and the rigging all together.
From there, we start adding leather, rigging, ground seat. I use an all-leather ground seat, which is what you're sitting on. Most of them use a metal plate and then cover it with leather.
As the work continues, Jim likes to have the customer come in for a sitting. After all, a good saddle is comfortable for both horse and rider. Making a quality saddle can have a tricky timeline. Jim says there are some parts of the process that once you start, you're committed to until that sequence is over, like once the weather is wet and you're putting it on the saddle in progress. And the leather does matter. The better it is, he says, the better that seat you're in all day.
Yes, yes. I use Herman Oak and Wickett and Craig, which are both American-made, American-tanned, is what I prefer. There are a lot of other leathers out there that are a little cheaper, but I really don't, you know, it's kind of like building something out of used material. If you build it out of used stuff, it looks used.
And he treats that leather with respect. Remember all those tools he has on the wall? There is something for every maneuver, for every task, for every job of any size.
We've got the little wicked tool here. This what they call a head knife or a round knife. This is what I cut all my leather with, cut my parts out.
Now, the shape suggests that it's a rolling sort of motion.
It can roll. Push it straight, or you can roll it. You can, you know, use the tip of it when you're cutting around corners and that sort of thing.
He has custom orders from ranchers who will spend 12 hours a day in a saddle, and from recreational riders who try to get in the saddle every weekend or so. With care, he says, a saddle can last a long time. Recreational riders who clean and oil their custom saddle should be able to leave that saddle to their children and to their grandchildren. And if they've taken care of that saddle, they should be able to see his stamp, a saddle maker's signature that's on his work. While some newer saddles are, like running shoes or bicycles, coming in lighter and lighter varieties, he says the really good saddles that will keep and last have a heft to them. His saddles, because of the good leather and the good rigging, weigh between 45 and 50 pounds.
So those old Westerns, when I would watch and they just kind of threw them on the horse, that's not quite accurate?
It's a little bit harder than that sometimes. You get used to it. Once you learn how to throw it on or how to put it on, it's a little bit easier. You've got to get that swing, you know, and get everything moving at one time.
Given his attention to detail, he rubs the edges of the saddle by hand, and his devotion to the tradition of his work, it's not surprising he prefers to do business in person. He does have a website, and he does have a Facebook page, but he says there's no substitute for eye contact when discussing the hows and whys of a custom saddle.
I will answer an email occasionally, but mostly I like to deal with people one-on-one.
And trade shows?
Trade shows, and people come out here, I'll help them out any way I can, show them whatever I can. I like to pass on the information.
Jim Harwell lives and makes saddles on the edge of the Illinois River in rural Prairie Grove. If you want to learn more, you can go to harwellsaddles.com or search for Jim Harwell on Facebook. You can also call him, get directions to his place on Shoemake Crossing Road, and enjoy learning more about his art. It is Sunday, August 4th. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Good morning. Want to talk about food?
Of course. It's my favorite thing to talk about.
It's one of my favorite things to talk about. You can't tell it by Christina, who's 8 feet tall and weighs 12 pounds. I, however, am 12 inches tall and weigh 800 pounds.
Kyle will vouch for me that I talk about food a lot.
Yes, okay. you're a fan of food, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, every week in What's Up, we profile a restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's not a review. It's just a little something interesting about a place that's new or different or sometimes venerable. And I thought I found a place that was new. Then I found out it was venerable.
Ah.
Okay, what is it?
Rivertown Barbecue in Ozark.
Now, you asked me about this.
Oh.
And I told you that I'd eaten there some time ago. And isn't it right there on the river with the railroad tracks behind it?
It is amazing.
Yeah.
And there's also a great story. The owners are named Pam and Kevin Doyle. And they were babies, like 19 and 21, when they started driving moving vans for a living. From Southern California, she didn't even own a winter coat. Their first run was to Maine, and she had to stop and buy a coat. And so they did this for a very long time, because now they've been married 40 years. They decided about 10 or 11 years ago that they really wanted to stop doing that. They wanted to quit living out of a suitcase. They found this building just off the square in Ozark, and they bought it. And they turned it into a barbecue restaurant.
And a pretty good one at that.
They knew nothing about barbecue. They
really?
Learned. Not a thing.
Now, wait. They knew nothing about it when they bought the building? Or they learned about it then bought the building?
No. They bought the building.
Okay.
They learned about it. They opened. The first day they were open, they sold out of everything and couldn't open the next day.
Wow, so they learned pretty well, it sounds like.
I bet they've eaten a lot of barbecue. Traveling from Southern California all the way to Maine, you probably...
You know what you like, at least. Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, they also learned that consistency was important because they said they ate at a lot of places that were great when they were new. Hmm. And when they went back by there 3 months later, they were horrible.
Ah.
So, yeah, they figured it out. And now they make their own rub, their own barbecue sauce, their own potato salad, their own spicy Rivertown beans, their own... salad dressing, all their own desserts. Mm-hmm. Oh my.
Pie?
I had cheesecake, actually.
Okay.
That had a caramel pecan layer above the graham cracker crust, and then caramel drizzled on top, and whipped cream.
Mm.
Why are we sitting here talking? Oh, wait, they're not open on Sunday. That's why we're sitting here talking. And it looks like the outside of the building, they've expanded from one little building to four, from like three or four employees to 27 or 28, which makes them one of the biggest employers in Ozark.
Interesting.
And when they quit counting, Pam says that they had served about 500 people between 4 and 8 o'clock every night.
Whoa.
How big is Ozark?
Oh, several thousand.
Okay. But they're getting business from Fort Smith, Van Buren, Fayetteville, Little Rock. Yeah, they couldn't survive on Ozark alone. But it's amazing. And you should check out our little restaurant stories every week and find these places. Or let me do it for you. Wait, there's a good idea.
Don't go until Becca tells you.
They're open from 11 to 2 and 4 to 8 Tuesday through Friday. And then all day from 11 to 8 on Saturday. You can't miss them if you hit the square in Ozark. And they're on the web at Rivertown with an E, BBQ. Also this afternoon, it's drop-in drawing at Crystal Bridges from 1 to 4. The Crawford County Chronicles is today at the Drennan Scott Historic Site in Van Buren at 2 o'clock. I'm betting they're full up.
I would call
and check at 262-2750. And Peter Pan is on stage at the Lyric Theater in Harrison, presented by the Theater Company and the Ozark Arts Council. And tickets for that are $8 to $18. And, of course, don't forget at 2 o'clock, The King and I at Rogers Little Theater.
What do you have to do to make Tinkerbell live? What are you supposed to do? Isn't there an interactive part where you're supposed to snap?
Yes, you have to say something.
Clap your hands?
Do you clap your hands? Okay. Something.
Well, we'll figure this out.
We don't want to give it away. Mm-hmm. Go find out for yourself at the Lyric Theater.
Exactly.
2011 census, Ozark, Arkansas, 3,669 people.
Okay. Thanks, Becca and Kyle. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And as we continue our leather-themed show, time now for our weekly montage. And this week it is focused on people in pop culture that wear leather. See how many of these you recognize.
Okay.
Easy action.
In the way. Throw me the idol. No time to argue. Throw me the idol. I throw you the whip.
Give me the whip.
Adios, señor.
Right into this world, all alone. God takes your soul, you're on your own.
Could you move that up a little bit? A little over to the left. Hey.
I didn't kill nobody. There was some of those guys just coming up the street after me, and I just took off, that's all. Maybe something hit my sickle or something like that. I don't know what happened. And I did a big brooding, and I went out, and that's all.
Morpheus, the line was traced. I don't know how.
I know. They cut the hard line. There's no time. You're going to have to get to another exit.
Are there any agents?
Don't hurt us, lady. Our take home's less than 300.
You're overpaid. Hit the road.
See how you did with our leather-themed montage? Just go to ozarksatlarge.com.
Mysterious sea imagery abounds in Zemlinsky's Die Seejungfrau, or The Mermaid, after Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of the KUAF Sunday Symphony, 7 to 9 p.m. Sunday night. Join me this Sunday for Zemlinsky's Die Seejungfrau Fantasy for Orchestra, performed by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, led by Ricardo Chailly. That's this Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KUAF Public Radio. The 2013 Fayetteville Roots Festival is Thursday, August 22nd through Sunday the 25th. This music festival will showcase Ozark culture, roots music, and local food, as well as organic and fair trade items, jewelry, live art, and exhibits. Tickets and more information are available at FayettevilleRoots.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Saddleback Mountain.
Where's that?
That is in Yell County, and it's about equal distance between Chula and Fouche Valley.
Awesome.
Neither one of those I've heard of either.
Okay, but. Well, it's in Yell County.
Okay. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.